Donald, reel number one. Captain Donald, could you begin by telling me of your recollections of your first associations with aviation?
I should say it began about the age of 10, I think that would be in 1906. I was very keen on the Wright Brothers flights and one or two earlier flights on the continent. And then Blériot's crossing of the Channel in 1909, and then came to a peak in 1910 when I had 2 days at the Lanark Aviation meeting in Scotland, which was really a very big show. During the 2 days, we were very lucky with the flying, because I remember the height record was broken up to slightly over 6,000 feet by an American pilot called Drexel. Old Cody was there, but his plane wasn't leaving the ground. It was then called the Flying Cathedral. It was a very interesting meeting, but that certainly brought my interest to a peak, and I did meet several of the pilots. Then the following year, I think it would be 1911.
Could I interrupt you just a minute there and ask you whether you have any recollections of Cody or Drexel?
Later, I met Cody the following year, but at the Lanark Aviation meeting, I'm afraid it was just a very hurried question of speaking to a real pilot, and that was about all.
Fine.
It was more the planes I was really keen on, getting an occasional chance to clamber into one. Then 1911, I think it was 1911, the first circuit of Britain race was run, and one of the turning points was Paisley Racecourse in Renfrewshire. And I know the race was won by a French pilot called, flying under the name of Beaumont. His right name was Lieutenant de Conneau of the French Navy, but he had to fly under the name of Beaumont for service reasons. Second was Vedrine, flying a Morane Borel. No, Morane. Third was a very good British pilot, and I'm sorry to say I've forgotten his name, flying a Defford Doussin. And then old Cody came in the old cathedral, which was now flying quite well. And it so happened that he was a bit delayed, so he stayed for 2 nights with my father, and I got to know him rather well, and managed to coax him into taking him with me on part of the race, the next leg of the race. But my father, unfortunately, wouldn't agree with this, because he thought I was a bit young, perhaps. And, however, before setting off, Cody did take a trial flight to test the weather from the race course, so I did have a passenger flight with him in 1911.
What do you remember of that flight? Could you describe it?
Not a great deal. It was a terrific thrill, of course, first time in the air, and a good look at the surrounding fields. We didn't go up very high. I don't suppose we went up more than about 300 feet at most, and did one wide circuit. We had a look at the weather and had a look at some of the high hills to the south, which were nearly 500 feet high, which seemed quite high in those days.
What are your recollections of Cody? What was he like as a man?
Oh, I thought the world of him. I mean, he's deliberately dressed like his cousin Buffalo Bill Cody, cowboy hat and little beard and moustache, and we expected him to produce a lasso at any moment, and he didn't actually do that. But he's an awfully nice chap, and he had a look at my big scale model I was making of an Antoinette monoplane that I rather liked. I remember him saying, looking at my ailerons, balanced ailerons, one went down and the other up, and he said, "Oh no, my boy, warp the wings, imitate the birds, my boy, imitate the birds." And at that time I didn't know that quite soon every plane would have balanced ailerons, but still, I liked them because they were easier to make. And that was the first flight anyway.
Was there much interest in aviation matters in Scotland at this time? Perhaps stimulated by the Cody flight and the Round Britain race?
I think there was. It's difficult for me to say at this distance, because after all I was 15 then. I'm a lot more now. But there wasn't actually any appreciable amount of real aviation in Scotland. There were one or two enthusiasts over at Bar Head in 1913. Early 13. And I'm sorry to say I've forgotten the names. I got in touch with them unofficially and had a few practice in taxiing and doing short hops in the plane they had. It was a sort of homemade box kite.
Just something they'd built themselves?
They built it themselves, but with quite a good Anzani engine, which I got later from them. But I've forgotten their name, I'm sorry to say. That was early 1913.
It was about 1913 that your own very practical participation in flying began.
Yes.
Could you describe how that started?
Well, it happened my father died in 1913. I'm afraid he would have stopped me if he'd been alive, but very shortly afterwards I was able to buy purely by correspondence from a chap at Brooklands an alleged Blériot-type monoplane, quite a good job, built by the Humber motor people, called the Humber Blériot. It was a very good copy of a Blériot, without engine. I forget the exact price, but I think it cost me one new Rudge motorcycle and £60, something of that sort, which was delivered near my mother's house in Renfrewshire about October 13, I think. And the engine it had in it was, I believe, an Anzani or Anzani-type engine, so I was able to get the Anzani engine from the chaps at Barhead. And it fitted her very well, without difficulty. We got it in the same engine bearers. So I had a very good engine. Forget the price, but it was very reasonable. They'd crashed their plane, and the engine wasn't much use to them. And I tried a reasonable Blériot monoplane with the only difference between it and a standard Anzani. I don't know whether it was a British-built copy of an Anzani, but instead of having the usual three cylinders disposed fan-wise, it had four. But it was a very powerful engine. It certainly was about 40-odd horsepower, which was quite a lot then. And it pulled the old Blériot about quite nicely. By just shortly before the end of 1913, I'd made one or two straight hops, managed to get back and make a landing of sorts in the next field.
I think at this stage, it's rather difficult for me to appreciate someone just climbing into an aeroplane and making a few hops, because of the emphasis which these days is put on training and things like that.
Well, of course, very few people could train you. You just had to train yourself in those days. I mean, you either taught yourself or you broke your neck. It was really quite a simple process. But flying is quite simple if you do it carefully. But I didn't fly very far, but the fact remains I flew the thing, and I did actually have a very mild half-turnover into a hedge and broke my one propeller, which was a pity. That was in the spring of 1914. And then, fortunately, a very good friend of ours, Major Gordon of the Royal Marine Light Infantry, who was then a member of what was called the RFC Naval Wing, as the RNAS had not yet been formed, asked me to come through and stay with them at Leven on the coast of Fife when the autumn manoeuvres were on in 1914. And he took me up once or twice.
I think you meant the spring manoeuvres.
I meant spring manoeuvres, yeah. Yes, because before the war. Spring manoeuvres of 14, and he very, very kindly and highly unofficially took me for one or two passenger flights in a converted short seaplane, which had been converted into a fine old land machine, short number 42, with dual control, and gave me some dual instruction, unofficially. And I enjoyed that tremendously, and it certainly gave me a better inkling into this question of landing the plane.
Was the aircraft concern actually employed in the spring manoeuvre?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Did you witness any of those manoeuvres?
Oh, yes. Hmm. Yes, I think I went up as Major Sandbag or something like that.
That was unofficial, then. I guess you took part in them.
Very unofficial, yeah. But probably at this late date nobody will take any action about it.
Were there any other pre-war flights which you took part in that you can recollect?
Yes. There was at the time there was a very well-known British pilot called B.C. Hucks, who was the first British pilot to loop the loop, and he had a special Blériot with a strengthened top caban so that his wings wouldn't fold down the way when he was looping or flying upside down. He was a brilliant pilot. And he was giving demonstrations at Glasgow, flying from Scotstoun Showground. And I went up there and met him and found that he could be coaxed into giving passenger flights for a small consideration. And he took me for a very nice flight round about the shipyards and up and down the River Clyde. And it was most enjoyable, at least it was enjoyable after we got clear of the shipyard cranes and things like that, because the Scotstoun Showground is not very big, and it's amazing how he lifted her out of it. But we circled right round that part of the Clyde for a while and then finally landed. It really was a very enjoyable flight, round the university and round the West End Park. Don't suppose we went higher than about 600 feet. Obviously, he didn't loop the loop, because he didn't do it with passengers. But that was the only other flight I had before the war.
Before you joined the Naval Air Service in July of 1914, no, later on, wasn't it, October 1914, before you actually joined the Air Service, how would you, at that stage, have evaluated your competence as a pilot?
Oh, at that time, I probably thought I was pretty good. But at this distance, I can assure you I was kidding myself. It really takes an appreciable number of hours in the air to learn to fly a plane properly.
Yeah.
But, I mean, at that time, I was quite capable of taking a plane off the ground and assuming it was a reasonable sized field, of putting it back into a field again without crashing. Without, we used to say in the old days that any landing you could walk away from was a good one.
Yeah.
I could do that.
Yes.
But but as I say, at that time one felt very competent.
Yeah.
But, you know, at 18 you're rather optimistic. Mm.
Could you describe for me your reasons and motives in joining the Naval Air Service in the summer, late summer of 1914?
Well, I wanted to, but it wasn't possible, unfortunately, because the Naval Air Service was formed in July. It turned out there's some absurd rule that you had to be 19. So it didn't look too good at the time. And it's pretty obvious there was a war coming along anyway. So that required some thought, because the point is, the only thing I was really keen on those days was flying. And in the family, we've had a certain amount of naval connection in the older days and sort of naval tradition. The naval side appealed to me.
Which came first, do you think? The desire to join, to take part in the war, or the desire to join to fly?
Oh, fly. Fly, fly mainly. But the war certainly added a spice of fun to it. So we thought.
Could you describe for me the course of events which led up to your joining the Naval Air Service?
Yes. The RNAS was established by the Admiralty in July 1914, and all the officers who had been officers and other personnel who had been known as RFC Naval Wing were then RNAS. Unfortunately, I discovered that in order to get a direct entry commission, RN, at that time you had to be 19. And this was rather difficult, because I was only 18. And it seemed rather obvious that there was a war on the way. So when the war started in August, the position looked a bit desperate, because everybody was saying that the war would be over by Christmas. And as I say, at that age, the idea of missing a perfectly good war seemed terrible. So finally, as Hendon Aerodrome was now a naval flying school, but with one or two private flying schools operating there by permission of the Navy, who wanted to see as many pilots trained as possible, I enrolled in Beattie School of Flying at Hendon in, I think September 1914, and went down just at the beginning of October 1914 and got started training on his dual control right biplane, a genuine American right biplane, twin propellers, chain driven, one of them with a cross chain, which makes most engineers shudder, and completely inherently unstable. And a lot of people used to say later on, if you could fly a right biplane, you could fly anything. And carried on training on that until my Lords of the Admiralty would change their mind about this 19 rule, which they did do quite shortly.
Could you describe for me the flying characteristics of this right biplane, which you did much of your training on?
Well, the fact remains it flew, and bar it had no front elevator, it was a dead spit of the ones that the Wright brothers first took off at Kitty Hawk in the United States. But the thing flew. And speed range, I should think, was about 3 knots, and probably flew level at about 42 knots. Began diving at 43, installed at 39 or 40, so you hadn't really much to play about with. The instrumentation was quite simple. There was a length of fine cords about 18 inches long tied to one of the struts in front of you. You kept your eye on the cords, and the idea being if they went sideways you were sideslipping, and if the cords suddenly went limp, the only thing to do was to sing "Nearer My God to Thee." At least so they used to say. And